Welcome to the Aftershock Central podcast with Travis and Martin.
What up, Aftershockers?
Where's Ronnie, you might ask? Save a little prayer for him. Maybe you should call the Leviathan to perk him up a little bit tonight.
Oh no!
Ronnie got stuck at work, so it's just Travis and I. No full Voltron, but that's okay. We've got two fantastic books to talk about. We'll be talking about A Walk Through Hell number 6 and the first original graphic novel, Witch Hammer. But first, we have news.
Yes.
I did my homework this time. See, Ronnie wasn't here, so I was like, I have to see if there's news, and there is. There is a new book announcement coming out March 20th, 2019, and that is Dark Red. It is written by Tim Seeley with art by Corin Howell, letters by Marshall Dillon, and a awesome cover by Aaron Campbell. And did you get to take a look at this?
A little bit. I took a little glimpse, and I think it's about vampires, yeah?
Yes, it's about a guy who's a vampire, and he's also a janitor. So, you know, he has to, like, finish his job up real quick and get home before the sun comes up.
Yeah, I mean, he's always cleaning up blood, you know, like, you know.
Yeah.
He's just applying his real-life skills.
Yes. I think the kind of the twist here is that this is, like, set in, I guess you could say, like, a Midwestern town. So his life as a vampire is not as exciting as a vampire would lead in, say, like, New York City, where there's plenty to do at night. And there's probably plenty of vampires there. He kind of leads a very lonely, crappy life in the Midwest as a janitor. And I guess hilarity ensues.
Oh, it's a comedy?
I don't know. I couldn't really tell. The pitch for the book and the solicit seems kind of like it could have some comedic elements. But I don't think it's like meant to be a comedy.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
well, it's dope that they got Tim Seeley, you know, like on a book, you know, that's right?
Tim did Brilliant Trash.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, cool. So that's pretty exciting. We'll see how it goes. I think it reminds me a little bit of, what's the, oh man, now I forgot the name of that book. Crap. There's a Donny Cates vampire book.
What, Rednecks?
That's the one.
I mean, he also did, Reactor and Interceptor or whatever, so,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but that's kind of like post-apocalyptic. I was thinking of Rednecks, which would be like the vampire version of Southern Bastards. So maybe in some way the theme of this is more reminiscent of Rednecks than anything else. I don't know. We'll see how it goes.
All right. Well, just to contextualize that, though.
Yes.
Southern Bastards and Rednecks take place in a shared universe.
Yes, they do.
As confirmed by Donny Cates. So, you know, maybe Tim Seeley, like, you want to throw in a little reference about, like, the Rebs or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like the universe could grow a little bit.
See, there you go. Now you're thinking.
I was putting it out there, dude.
Somebody throw Travis, like, 25 cents for that. That's a good idea.
Yes.
I like it. So yeah, that's pretty exciting. New book coming in March of 2019. All right, let's talk about this week's books, because this is kind of a heavy week, Travis. Even though we only had two books, and the past couple of weeks we've had like four books every week, I think there's a lot to dive into in these two.
Oh, awesome, man. Yeah, for sure.
So let's kick things off talking about A Walk Through Hell number 6, written by Garth Ennis with art by Goran Satsuka. Colors by Ives Warsina, and letters by Rob Steen. Now, this is the beginning of the second arc of the book, so I think we had like a little short break in between issues 5 and 6. We're back in the warehouse, and there's some new twists being thrown into the story. And I wanted to talk about these new twists and see what you thought about them.
For sure, dude.
So, we kick things off in the warehouse with the two agents, and they're kind of trying to have a discussion of whether they're dead or not. Right? Because they're trying to figure out, like, how long they've been in the warehouse, whether it's been hours or days or weeks. And the guy's like, well, you know, my beard's still growing. And the girl's like, well, I should have had my period by now, and I haven't. Dead bodies can grow hair, but dead bodies can't menstruate. So I guess maybe we're dead. And the guy's like, I don't think we're dead, but maybe they are dead?
I've been at They're Dead since issue one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is that not, like, the assumption when, you know, like, it seems like everything points to that they're in hell right now.
Yes. But the question, the question still remains is, why would he be in hell? We already know that she killed the serial killer in cold blood, but what has he done that would land him in hell?
It's possible that it could be tied to, the stuff that Sean was doing in this investigation. Or there could be a revelation about something else, you know, in a future issue. But thing being that I recognize is that whatever the dude's name is, with the goatee and Shaw, mm-hmm. Seem like they're the only ones who are in hell together. You know, like the rest of them are all alone, including Driscoll, who goes in this issue. They're all by themselves, but Shaw and whatever his name, they're together in this. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's some connection there.
Hunzinger. Is that him?
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. Maybe. Oh, no, here we go. McGregor. That's the guy. Hunzinger was the other guy that came in. The guy that had the partner that kept shooting himself in the face.
Yeah.
All right. So, yes. Well, I mean, didn't those two go in together? Even though
But
they got separated.
Yeah. Like where we see them inside, they're by themselves.
Right.
And I guess Shaw and McGregor walk up to him or whatever, but he seems oblivious to them. So I don't know. It's just something that struck me that was interesting about it, because I feel like, Hunzinger and Goss, we see a kind of an experience that's personalized to them. You know, that's not really related to their, policing or anything in a transparent way. But, they're by themselves in it. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was interesting.
Sure. So what do you make of Driscoll deciding to go in to, I'm assuming, rescue her people? Because she does seem to have a really good relationship with Shaw and McGregor and everybody else.
I was wondering about that too. And my assumption was that... seems like she's kind of got nothing to lose, you know, but they kind of make vague references to, I guess, that she's on her way out. Like it's transitional period and she has no more authority because she's kind of been compromised or implicated in the looking into this troubled investigation for Shaw and McGregor. Mm-hmm. And it's unclear, I guess, as far as I know, whether. She has a kind of a general or specific idea that, about that Shaw killed this guy, how much she knew about that thing that brought this investigation to a close, I don't know. It's interesting, I guess, that on her phone inside the warehouse, Driscoll's phone, she's talking to McGregor, right?
So I was trying to figure out who she was talking to. Because we never see McGregor on his phone, but she's definitely talking to somebody. Now, I don't know if it's either Shaw or McGregor, but it seems like her personal hell is having lost one of her agents for some reason at some point in the past. And maybe that's her motivation for going in and trying to rescue Shaw and McGregor.
Yes. It seems like it's Goss. Okay. So Goss is the one who, keeps shooting himself, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I feel like that could be pointing to something specific about something that happened with Goss, but I'm not totally sure.
Do you think that maybe she was in a relationship with Goss?
Well, I got the sense from this issue that she swings the other way, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of unclear, but she does have – there's an interesting flashback towards the end. And I think that's where things get really interesting is after that flashback sequence. Because she's not like a yes man, right? And that kind of plays throughout the issue where the director is sitting there and she's like, look, you can transfer me to Anchorage or whatever. I don't really care. I'm going to go in and see what the hell's going on. But then when you get that flashback scene, you learn a little bit more about how the agency works and the types of stereotypes that are put on her as a woman. Right, where she's kind of expected to sit back and do what she's told, and the director and some of the other higher ups in the FBI maybe aren't very receptive to strong women And there's a lot of, like, sexual innuendo discussed in some of these meetings that she's recounting. So I don't know. I couldn't really tell if that was the intention of showing her as a lesbian. But it definitely shows her off as not really caring what her superiors want her to do, more about what the right thing to do is.
Okay, I can see that.
Yeah. And right now, to her, doing the right thing is going in and seeing what the hell's going on. Because nobody wants to go in, right? The cops are all scared with good reason, right? Their whole SWAT team killed each other. The director, I mean, I doubt he knows what's going on, but because events are so strange, he wouldn't want to lose an assistant director. Whereas an agent, maybe it wouldn't be that big a deal. So I don't know. But I think that whole flashback sequence with Driscoll talking to Sean McGregor at the end is pretty interesting. And it raised a lot more questions, I think, as to the overall structure and ultimate revelation of the story. Because the character that's introduced in the end, that's not the serial killer that we've been seeing the entire time, is it? The old man that she's interviewing at the prison?
No, I don't think so.
And yet he's definitely connected to this, because she's recounting a story about how he used to be a Nazi. And, you know, after he left Germany after the war, he became like a winemaker or something. And he recounts, like, basically how he missed the days of being a Nazi, because, like, Hitler was so awesome to hear him speak. And he talks about an interaction he had with a soldier in front of a church in Paris. And then at the end, we see Sean McGregor, the whole landscape of this hellscape changes, and they're kind of placed in front of this church that this character is describing. And it seems like maybe he shows up outside of the church as well, just as a much younger man, right? He's no longer 80 plus or whatever how old he is. He seems to be a young guy, maybe in his 30s.
Are you talking about in the actual, like, Paris flashback at the end, or are you
Right before the actual flashback. Hmm. McGregor and Shaw are walking, and they see the light, and she's like, they're like, well, do we go through the light? Is that the way out? And all of a sudden, the whole landscape changes. They're like, wait, like, things are changing. What's happening? And then you see, like, the gargoyles and all the stuff that this guy was recounting in his story about the description of the church. And then you see the guy there, like, he's talking in parables about God and this, that, and the other. And then you get the actual flashback to him sitting outside the church. So it has me thinking, like, okay, the church that he's describing that we see in that last page is the church that Sean McGregor are in. And if that's the case, what the hell does this have to do with that whole situation?
So my reading of that was, in the recounting of that discussion, you know, the story about this guy and the other Nazi, like, in Paris, the payoff for that seemed to be that they were talking about Notre Dame, and basically he was like, they did it, you know, like it's kind of a visual representation of the horrors of hell. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yes, yes, yes.
So that, I think, is like, you know, for that reason, it's now appeared here, you know, in, you know, hell or whatever. And, like, I guess my confusion is, you know, who is causing that to happen, you know, being that that's kind of an experience that we saw shared by the two detectives and Driscoll. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and it happens right after Driscoll comes inside, basically.
Yeah.
So I figure there's something to that, that one of them is causing that to appear.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So she's projecting this imagery onto whatever hellscape Sean McGregor in.
Yeah, or they're remembering it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, just I remembered, you know, like, Garth Ennis, you know, like I feel like he needs to throw a Nazi in every book somewhere.
What? Garth Ennis? No.
Well, like, you know, they're in Preacher and The Boys and I mean, I think there was something else,
well,
too.
I mean, the thing is, he loves doing wartime stories, right? So anything he does kind of, I don't know, he tries to represent some of that wartime stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, pretty
interesting. I think it's just shocking, you know, like that's still something that you know is edgy, you know. Mm-hmm. So for shock value, like, why not put a you know, real Nazis in there?
Mm-hmm. Well, the guy says some pretty interesting things, though. He says, "Yeah, I've got the page in front of me. The tabernacle of God is with men, and He will dwell with them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself shall be with them, and be their God. And God shall wipe away all their tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away." So yeah, I mean, I think that kind of goes back to that whole, well, maybe they are dead kind of thing, right? So they're maybe stuck in limbo, not necessarily paying for their sins, but maybe reliving some of the moments they regret. And they won't necessarily be hurt, because God is with them, but at the same time, they'll just not really go anywhere else. They'll just be stuck in this place. I don't know. The whole thing is very, very esoteric, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure where it's going specifically, but you know, my assumption, it being it's called Walk in Hell, is, you know, that they're in hell, you know?
Mm-hmm. Or it could be like in Her Infernal Descent, where we kind of determined that maybe there was no real walk through hell. It was just kind of this whole thing of going through the different stages of grief kind of thing. I don't know. This one seems like it'd be a little more real than that one, right? Just based on the way that Garth Ennis writes his books. I don't think it's as metaphorical as Her Infernal Descent was.
I mean, I think it is metaphorical in a sense, but I'm not sure what it's symbolizing yet.
So question for you, and then we'll wrap this one up. Does it bother mm-hmm. you at all that we're six issues in and still have no idea what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, bother is, you know, kind of strong. Like, I think it's, you know, it's that's not unfair to say that I kind of feel that way. And I also, I don't know, like, is there any indication how long it's going to be as a series?
I think it's ongoing.
Yeah, so it could be, like, quite long.
Yeah, it could be 50 issues before we find out.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess there's a trade-off there. Like, if it's going to – the longer it purports to go, maybe the more you might want to be like, let's get a hint where it's going. Mm-hmm. You know, or, you know, if it's not going to be, like, that kind of epic length, then maybe it's easier to be along for the ride.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about that after I read this issue, and I read this a couple of times, because I think it warrants paying attention to a lot of things. And I don't think I'm really disappointed that we don't know anything, because to me, I'm just really enjoying living in this world and just seeing how these people react to being in this place. And there's a lot of, like, creepy side characters, and there's a lot of, like, really interesting stories. And I think there's plenty more that could be told. Like, you know, the whole thing with Driscoll and the flashback sequence, I thought that was really interesting. And not once did we mention the serial killer or the mall murders or anything like that, which have been kind of key in the background of the first arc of this. And I really enjoyed it. And I'm really curious to see who this new character is and how he plays out in the overall arc of the story.
Yeah, I mean, if the situation is that all these characters that are starting to show up, like this Nazi guy and Callahan, are really there and they're going to be recurring characters, you know, and you're going to build this large cast of unseemly characters, you know, like, that's interesting. So, mm-hmm. So if that's where they're going, then, you know, I think it's great, you know, that, you know, mixed with, as you're saying, kind of, you know, the cross-cutting between current and, like, flashbacks that, you know, speak to a mystery of these characters' past. You know, like, I think that format is interesting, too. Mm-hmm. So if that's what it is, I could be okay for it being, you know, an ongoing thing.
Yeah. Cool, let's rate it up. Travis, give me your score, buddy.
I'll go 4 out of 5. And, you know, like, we never talk about art that much, but I, you know, I've always liked the art on this series, so yeah, I like it.
Cool. I'm gonna go I'll go 4 out of 5 on this. I think I would rate it higher because I think it was a really strong beginning to the new arc, but again, because I don't feel like we're really progressing into what this book is about, it makes me want to hold back the score, even though I kind of want to rate it higher. So, yeah. All right, let's move on to Witch Hammer, the first original graphic novel from Aftershock. It's, what, 64 pages, I think? Really, really cool story. It is written by Cullen Bunn, with art by Dalibor Telajic, Sebastian Kemagaj... Dang, I said it better in the pre-show. Sebastian Kemajevic? Yeah, sure, we'll go with that. Is on the art assist, and then Marshall Dillon on letters.
You got cocky.
I did, dude, and when I said it in the pre-show, like, it just came right out. And now, not so much. But at least I said Dalibor's name correctly, so that's all that matters.
Yeah.
All right, so this is a cool... First, I gotta say, cool new type of book for Aftershock, right? I think the Aftershock playing around with the graphic novel market is actually really interesting. It's not quite, you know, like a full-length trade. Those would have, you know, what, 120 pages or so, so it's about half that. But I like that they're doing this. So these are coming out oversized hardcovers, and they're just original books, like one-shots, by some great creators. So we got Cullen's doing the first one. We've got one by Marguerite that's going to be coming out. What was the third one? Is the third one the Garth Ennis one?
Sounds right.
Yeah, I can't remember, but I remember Marguerite's is the next one. And I really enjoyed the story. I think it really plays to Cullen's strengths as a writer, because he's really into this whole, like, mystical side of things, right? I think, I don't know how he feels about it. Maybe we should ask him about kind of always being known as the horror guy. And obviously Cullen loves horror, or he would not be doing horror books. But I wonder sometimes how he feels about that, right? Cause people know him as the guy that writes horror. And this is definitely, well, I don't know about definitely, but kind of a horror story. It's also kind of a, I don't know, murder mystery, kind of like, I would even say maybe a little spy thriller-esque. There's a lot to play around with here. And, of course, with a Cullen Bunn twist, because we have, it's not a demon-worshipping cult, but a cult that worships a different god. It's hard to pick the right words, you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to be like a pagan god, but I mean, I guess it would be a pagan god. I thought it was really interesting, the way that the story progressed. I think, the length of the book was maybe enough, although I feel like as we talk about this, I think you might agree that there's probably plenty of room for more story in this world, especially
well,
with
don't
that
they?
End.
Yeah, don't they basically say like you have more work to do at the end or something?
Yeah. But the way that it's so... done is interesting, right? Because it's not the character we've been following the entire book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So give me some thoughts about this. What'd you think?
Well, I thought you had some knowledge to lay down about, the subject matter,
yes.
but from a bird's eye before you get to that, I think my initial reaction is, you know, like, you know, I definitely, you know, I like it. I think it's cool mood and the art was great. There's a lot to like, but I kind of wish it was longer.
Yeah.
You know, and like some of that, I guess, has to do with like, you know, things that aren't necessarily, you know, laid out. But I think it's a strong enough kind of premise and presentation that, you know, I would have loved to read it in kind of traditional miniseries or like a trade length.
Hmm.
But there's a lot to think about in this one, and you know, plenty of action as well.
Yes, so I'll drop some knowledge, and it's too bad that Ronnie isn't here, because I know Ronnie is aware of this book as well. The book that I'm assuming was kind of the basis for the idea of this book. In fact, it takes its name from this book, the Malleus Maleficarum, translated from Latin into the Hammer of Witches, hence Witch Hammer. In fact, if you, when you read this book, you will actually see one of the characters reading the Malleus Maleficarum. Did you catch that?
Yeah, I didn't know what the text was, but that was conspicuous.
Yeah, so I was kind of glad that it was thrown in here, because when I thought about the title Witch Hammer, I was like, that sounds oddly familiar. And I looked it up, and I was like, oh yeah, Hammer of the Witches. And one of the detectives, we'll call him Hipster Mulder. just like Frontenac is Hipster Scully. He is reading the Malleus Maleficarum in the car because they're I guess they work for the FBI is my assumption. I don't think that's ever explicitly said, but it's definitely one of those kind of agencies, right? And they're
federal, yeah.
Yeah. And they're researching a string of murders across the country that seem to have some kind of supernatural bent. And as part of the research for investigating this serial killer, the guy is reading the Malleus Maleficarum. And you can't really make it out in the panel. When he throws it in the back seat, you can kind of see it says Maleficarum on the bottom. But if you had never heard of it, you probably wouldn't even know what to look for. So we'll drop some knowledge on the Malleus Maleficarum. Written in 1487, it was the first manual of witch hunting, if you were unaware. It was written in Germany by Henrik Kramer, who was a member of the Inquisition. He was doing the witch trials in Germany at the time. And if you know anything about witch trials, you know that they're all basically BS. And much of the time they were kind of taking place because people accusing others of witchcraft wanted something from those people. Generally, for example, in the Salem witch trials, which the Salem witch trials used a version of the Hammer of the Witches. In the Salem witch trials, it was more about property ownership. And so people would say other people are witches, so they would die, and then they could either take their property or buy it extremely cheap. As far as this particular guy, Henrik Kramer, there's he was kind of a weird guy. He wasn't, like, excommunicated, but the Catholic Church didn't really like the guy because he took this witch hunting stuff really seriously, and they didn't really believe that there was power in witchcraft, which is actually pretty interesting considering the horrific crap the church did with the Inquisition and then after that. But I read some things about this guy, and it seems like maybe one of the ladies that he was accusing of witchcraft he had basically a hard-on for, and she paid him no attention. So he basically accused her of being a witch. And I think the reason why she was accused is that she dabbled in, like, folk remedies, and of course that was kind of seen as witchcraft. And maybe killed a nobleman as a result of the potions that she was making, so that's why she was kind of marked as a witch by the church. And the trial didn't go very well. She was determined not to be a witch, and our buddy Kramer here got super pissed off and went off, I think, to Italy after leaving Bavaria, and he wrote The Hammer of the Witches as a manual on how to determine if someone's a witch, the history of witchcraft, the power that witchcraft can or cannot have, and then also like a treatise on the power of God versus the power of the devil, etc. And some of that stuff is actually in this book, towards the end. There's a couple of lines that I thought were really interesting. And if I can find them on here, I'll read them in Witchhammer itself. But there's a couple of lines that were pretty interesting, and they were kind of taken from the Hammer of the Witches, except turned a little bit on their side. And this happens towards the end when they're talking about, like, the power of God and the power of Leviathan. And in the Hammer of the Witches, basically the first chapter deals with how the devil doesn't really have power because God's power is greater than the devil's. Whereas in Witchhammer, we get a line similar to the power of God is the same as the power of the devil, and why that is. And I think it's the leader of the cult, the witch coven, that recites this line before they go and find her in Colorado. And I thought that was pretty cool. There's some stuff on here about how, like, because of the power of the devil, he can't really turn people into demons. And in Witchhammer, we see her doing a ritual to turn people into demons. I thought that was really cool. So it kind of turns some of the stuff that's in the original text of Hammer of the Witches, or Hammer of the Witch, to on its side, and kind of pokes fun of it a little bit in a way. But still kind of being true to what this book says about certain things. And I didn't read the whole thing. I did find a PDF copy online for free, so it's not like a pirate copy. So I'll put a link in the show notes to that PDF if anyone wants to check it out. I did read like the first couple of chapters, and it's fascinating. I'm gonna read like this whole freaking thing because this dude is pretty serious. He takes his witch hunting very serious. So there's some knowledge for you, Travis. The Malleus Maleficarum.
That's dope, dude. But let me ask you, how do you think that book kind of comes into this story? You know, because we see it with Detective Guy, right?
Yes.
Does he know that they're hunting witches, or does he know that, like, this killer that they're on the trail of is hunting witches?
So I think that's something that's not explicitly said, I don't think. And I was kind of trying to figure that out myself. Because they're definitely hunting this guy for being a serial killer. And the reason he's reading the Malleus Maleficarum is to gain some insight into why he's killing a particular way, right? And that's not like anything out of the ordinary, right? If you were an FBI agent doing research on a serial killer who is basing his or her killings on whatever, like the Bible, right? Like, you probably want to go and read the Bible, right? Like, if a serial killer left a passage from whatever, Psalms, on a mirror written in blood, well, you know, you go read Psalms and try to figure out why that is.
Yeah, we've seen Seven, dude.
Yeah, exactly. Like Seven, okay? Except here, instead of the Bible, you have this manual for witch hunting, which, I mean, presumably the killer would be aware of, having been a part of a witch coven and now being a witch hunter. My assumption is he would have read the Malleus Maleficarum and kind of based his vendetta on some of the stuff written in that book.
I mean, I'm just curious, kind of, you know, because you mentioned kind of techniques for killing witches, and I have to imagine that doesn't include, you know, automatic bullet fire. So, like it almost suggests to me that, you know, he had, like, wrote a note or something that or like, they saw, like, some writing that was, you know, had to do with the witches. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that all is just a little bit tantalizing about the, like, kind of mise-en-scene about where you drop in. And you're like, how long is this investigation going on? How many bodies? Like, where are they? Because it seems like they're dropping into all this stuff about a cult and whatever. Like, they don't really, like, tip their hat that they have any idea it has to do with witches, etc.
Well, you know, my question really is, are these guys just, like, looking for this guy because he's a serial killer, or are they more than that, right? Like, are they aware that there are witches? And I think maybe that kind of goes with your question, because I can't really tell, right? And the reason I call them Hipster Scully and Hipster Mulder is because it gives me that vibe, right? Where it's like Mulder and Scully researching an X-File. Except, like, they're a little weird, because they're dressed like they're straight out of the 1880s, but it's modern day,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, he looks like Sherlock Holmes or something, right? He's got the big twirly mustache and his little cap, and then, I forgot her name, Frontenac. It took me a second. I'm not good with French names. Frontenac, she's... I don't know. She's got like a 60s Austin Powers suit, but with like the frilly neck in it. I don't know, man. I don't know. Like the design for the main two characters, I say, is a little off the beaten path, right? So it makes me wonder, like, are these guys like actual, I don't know, like, do they hunt cults like as part of an agency, or are they just FBI agents looking for a serial killer? Like, I don't think that's really explicitly said anywhere.
You're talking about like an X-Files type thing. It's not like a cult task force where most of the time it's like you go on you're on the milk cult or whatever, where they're just like a suicide cult or whatever, or there's like child brides, you know, like, you know, cults as we know them in our world versus like if a team like that stumbled onto this, they'd be like, whoa, you know, like this is like, religion is real. We got to rethink this whole, like, our whole business.
Mm-hmm. By the way, since we're talking about cults, I forgot to mention this when we're talking about A Walk Through Hell. The Nazi guy that Driscoll is talking to, he looks exactly like the leader of Heaven's Gate. Remember that guy?
Mm-hmm.
What was his name? Doe or whatever? He looks exactly like him. You should go look a picture of the Heaven's Gate guy, and you'll be like, holy crap, it's that guy.
Yeah, I can see that.
All right, anyway, so, yeah, and the cult thing's not, like, really brought up immediately either, right? And I think once we learn about the cult, things go pretty quick to the end.
I'd say it comes up pretty much immediately once you get into, like, real, like, discussion, you know? Like, they talk to the cop, and immediately he's like, oh, we got to go to the Dietrich's farm, you know? Right. Like, that's what everything around here kind of revolves around or whatever. And everybody, it's like the worst kept secret, you know? But they must not suspect him of anything too bad, or else, you know, the police would have done something, you know?
Well, but that's because the Dietrich house isn't like the main place where the cult is. That's where like kids go that are like interested in seeing what the hell the cult's about.
Okay.
Right? The cult is in Colorado in that mansion.
Well, that's a new location, I think.
Yes.
I think they implied that.
But that's like where the inner circle is. That's where the power lies. Because the leader's there, and then her coven is there.
Yeah. And to that point, like, I think that also is part of it, that they may be protected by some of their connections, mm-hmm. you know, like helps them stay whatever clean. But I think that is one of the interesting things about this story is kind of the connection between, you know, like this type of cult or, you know, magic, but also kind of your like real world, like conspiratorial, you know, like power and hegemony. You know, I think that's an interesting part of the story.
Yeah. And along the way, you get a few twists, right? So when the book kicks off, what kicks off this whole hunt for, I mean, we can call the serial killer Leviathan because they call him that in a few places, even though he's not like the actual Leviathan. We have a group of kids who the driver gets shot, they get into a wreck, all of them die except one, and then she starts performing a ritual in order to gain Leviathan's protection, except it's obviously not working. She gets killed. That's when the agents get involved, and we go through this whole process to get to the Dietrich house, where we learn that, okay, now we're dealing with a cult, right? Because you have all the naked people in the back room with their eyes burnt out. I thought that was pretty interesting. And I want to talk about that maybe a little bit later in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the eyes are burnt out because, what's the guy's name? Nance. He's not the one burning the eyes.
No.
So I thought that was kind of cool.
The girl in the beginning has their eyes burned out, and the person at the end has their eyes burned out, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, so everyone in that room had their eyes burnt out except that one guy. All right. So I think where things start to get interesting is when we meet the televangelist, which I thought that whole sequence of events was hilarious. Hilarious in a good way. And I don't know if like Cullen threw it in purposely to be funny, but to me it seemed funny. Because here you have a televangelist who, you know, has millions of people watching him. Everyone donates money to him. They buy his books. They make him rich. But he doesn't believe in anything that he says. You know, like he calls the people sheep. And really we find out that he is part of this coven and he worships Leviathan as well. And the reason why he does that I thought was kind of cool as well. Because since he's a servant of Leviathan, he is misleading people into believing in his teachings on purpose, because even though he preaches about God and Jesus, ultimately the way that he preaches about it would lead people away from God and not towards God. And I thought that whole thing was really interesting.
Yes. Leviathan recruits from betrayed Christians.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting, like in the exchange where they're talking about all that stuff, just they kind of mention something to the effect of, like, why don't you just, like, tell these people what's up? Tell them about Leviathan, basically, you know? Mm-hmm. And he made his kind of response to that was about, like, they're not ready, you know? Like they aren't willing to do what's necessary to take the sacrifice, you know? Right. And I thought that was interesting because, like, I think central to this story, it's all about faith in a lot of ways, you know, mm-hmm. and like like the guy who's running around killing people, you know, like his problem, I guess, is that he didn't have faith, you know, and like that's why he like he doesn't have the power and things didn't work out, you know.
Yeah. And I want to talk about that next, because I think it's after this whole thing with the televangelist that we learn why this guy is doing what he's doing. But I found that whole thing really interesting and to me very personal. So I decided when I was like 18 or 19 that I didn't want to go to a church anymore. And it didn't sit well with my parents. I mean, my mom was pretty understanding. My dad not so much, because my dad was a preacher. And so that would look bad on him, I suppose. My mom was a little more understanding of things. But I remember one thing that my mom told me that really stuck with me and still sticks with me as we're having this conversation, because she wanted to understand why, and I kind of tried to explain to her why. And one of the things that she told me was something to the effect of, like, she wished that she would be able to do what I was doing. Because I think, like, if you're involved in a belief system for long enough, it's not necessarily just about what you believe in, right? But also like the community that you build around yourself, right? Because you're with like-minded people who share a belief in something. And if you decide that that belief is no longer yours, then how does that change everything else that you base your life on, right? In particular, when it's something based on faith and a religious group. And that always stuck with me because it really rings true for a lot of these cult type organizations. And I'll even include a lot of the televangelists because to me they are very cult-like. Just maybe a little more mainstream and accepted because it's a Christian cult, but a cult nonetheless. And I thought that whole thing was fascinating. And again, very personal to me. So I really enjoyed that few sequence of pages.
Yeah. I mean, I do wonder though about kind of, you know, the messages, you know, like your to your point about community, you know, it seems like, you know, that's where the kind of cults as we think of them maybe veer from, like the positive stuff that you get in maybe other religious sects about community where like basically there's, you know, a hierarchy here that's like really making people, its followers, like grist for the mill, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of abuse arguably maybe is slightly more overemphasized in your fringe cult situations.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about Nance's motivation for doing this whole thing.
Okay.
Cause I think that thing was pretty interesting as well. So we learned that he was a Marine in the military and became very disillusioned with what he had to do as a soldier and ended up becoming religious, and as a result found this cult and felt that there was great power in the cult. His wife, I'm assuming, is it said that she died in an accident? Like, I feel like that's what was said, but I could be making that up.
I don't remember much about the wife.
Yeah, I know she died, and so he came to the coven to see if they could find a way to bring his wife back. And the ritual to bring the wife back involved him killing his kids, basically, sacrificing them to Leviathan. And this is kind of where the lines from the Malleus Maleficarum kind of show up that I referenced earlier. Because in this book, the power of Leviathan is equal to the power of God. So there's some back and forth about that in this issue. And I can't remember the exact wording. But they, you know, they basically talking the same kind of metaphor, right? Like God works in mysterious ways and so does Leviathan. And so you have to maybe partake in these weird rituals, but you know, they really only have power if you have faith in them, right? If you believe in the power of Leviathan, just like the televangelist preaches that, you know, you can have all these nice things like I have if you believe in God. And I thought that thing was really interesting because it really like kind of hit at the core of religious belief, I guess, in some way, right? And this guy believed enough and wanted his wife back enough that he felt like sacrificing his kids was the right thing to do. He was also promised that, you know, if the ritual was successful, that not only would his wife come back, but the children he sacrificed would be brought back to life. But after he does it, he has remorse because he just killed his kids. And as a result, he no longer has faith and what he believed in before, and the ritual is never completed. And to me, that whole thing is fascinating because I've always been fascinated by how religious beliefs, or we'll just say spiritual beliefs, affect the way people decide to lead their lives. And I think about stuff like Aleister Crowley, for example, which I think we brought up on the podcast before. You know, he had like the whole sex magic thing. And the thing about sex magic is, you know, a lot of the magic rituals that they perform are not so much about the ritual themselves, but about how much you believe the rituals to be true, right? Regardless of how crazy and ridiculous they might seem. And I know, I'm sure Ronnie's listening and he's going to be very upset that he wasn't part of this conversation, because I'm going to bring up Grant Morrison, and Grant Morrison's got that same idea, right? Grant Morrison's played around with that idea of willing magic to reality, based on pure will alone in his books. And that's kind of the philosophy of this coven, and kind of how they make things come true based on rituals. And Grant Morrison's played around with this a little bit. He had that one crazy idea where, you know, he's a comic book writer, right? So he creates characters and creates stories for these characters. But what if, like, those characters are real, right? So to them, he would be like their god, right? Like their all-knowing entity. Because he's the one guiding their stories. And as a result, like, if that's the case, then wouldn't he as a writer have somebody above him that, like, creates his stories? So he came up with this, like, weird, like, triangle pyramid, like, alien things, that live in, like, you know, separate dimension that kind of write our stories. And the way that it's phrased is kind of weird, but, like, it makes you think about that kind of thing, right? Like, if we as people can have the thought to create stories and create worlds, then what's to say that, like, there couldn't be something else that creates our stories? And I think that's really interesting.
Sure. I think that all speaks to kind of the idea that, you know, belief makes things real. Yeah. You know, like can make things real because it's believed in, you know, like, yep, be it Tinkerbell or Animal Man or, you know, whatever. And like, certainly that, you know, kind of, that's a big part of, I think, this story. And, you know, I think it's, you know, it's worth saying that it seems like kind of also like would be a convenient excuse for a charlatan, like as for somebody that, you know, purports to be a magician or,
yeah,
like a religious figure or what have you, that they could, you know, it's kind of like, oh no, all you have to do is believe in me or whatever, you know, and when it doesn't work, you're like, didn't believe enough. Not right. My fault. It's on you.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. In this case, obviously, the magic is real. So, you know, like that message maybe doesn't apply. I guess that's kind of what makes it interesting. Like it really sells home that thing that, like, yeah, this guy's pissed off because he didn't believe enough and he didn't get what he wanted out of it.
Yeah, exactly. Because it didn't work immediately, right? And that's something that I remember hearing growing up in church. Like, if you want something, you pray for it. And if God wants you to have it, then you'll have it, right? And maybe if you pray hard enough, then God will give it to you. But maybe it works that way for some people by a matter of coincidence. I mean, I don't want to talk about anyone's religious beliefs, but, you know, really it's about, like, what you make of the situation. And, you know, he sacrificed his kids to get his wife back. It didn't happen immediately, so he's like, well, this is all BS. I'm just going to start killing you all. But the interesting twist here is that maybe he's being guided by Leviathan or something, right? Some kind of entity. Because we see all these people that he's taking revenge on get their eyes burnt out. And at first you assume that he's the one doing it. But then you see him have these visions of like a blindfolded angel type creature. And it seems like maybe that creature is the one burning out the eyes.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know who or what that creature was, mm-hmm, whether that's Leviathan or what, but, I didn't necessarily assume a connection between, Nance and, you know, whatever that thing is, you know, but, I was definitely curious about that too. My assumption was that it had some connection to Leviathan or something, to all that, you know, not necessarily to the old lady, you know, like, it seemed like the best she could do was turn people into monsters, but well, that yes. maybe, like,
but that
that's
was
the real god they worship or something.
But that was through the power of Leviathan, right? The Leviathan that they worship, not Leviathan Nance pretending to be this goat demon thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought that was it. I couldn't tell either. And maybe that goes along with that whole thing of belief, right? If he no longer believed in the Leviathan, then maybe he created this other higher being and was able to channel some kind of power through that based on pure belief alone.
But if he could channel that power, why would he go through the trouble of killing some people with guns and axes?
Dude, because Leviathan works in mysterious ways.
Ah. Yeah, and kind of my assumption, I don't know, it was like that it was kind of part of that faction or whatever that was basically trying to like get the followers out, you know, or like I don't know, it's whenever they're faced with him, right? Mm-hmm. That's when the eyes burn out. So I don't know, I'm unclear why, I guess.
Yeah, no, I gotcha. I'm not really entirely clear either, so I'm just making assumptions on the story. But yeah, I don't know. It's really interesting. I don't think I've ever seen a comic tackle this type of subject in the way that it's tackled, you know? I've read stories on like real life cults, and that's kind of the way it works in those stories. But I've never seen a comic tackle it in that way. And I think it definitely brings up a lot of interesting questions that I don't think a comic has ever had me think about before. And as a result, I really enjoyed it because of that.
Yeah, for sure, man.
Yeah. All right, so let's get to the end then. So Nance ends up finding the leader of the cult. He goes in there, guns blazing, basically kills the entire coven. Frontenac and her partner show up. And, you know, Frontenac is kind of conflicted as well, right? Because she doesn't know if, like, this is real or not, just like we don't know if it's real or not. But obviously there's some kind of power here, right? So you see the Mrs. Hayes, the televangelist's wife, get turned into a demon or a witch in their vehicle as they're driving off and trying to protect her. The head of the coven turns a bunch of other people into these demon things because she feels like they are no longer like fully invested, I guess, right? So the ritual says something about like, you know, the unbelievers, like you turn the unbelievers into whatever, something, some kind of creature. I can't remember what the exact ritual was. And, so all these other people are turning into demon things. And, you know, Nance really takes care of them. He kills all of them. He ends up killing the leader of the coven and then ends up dying himself as a result of this whole battle. I think he gets shot several times along the way as he's trying to find the leader of this cult. And Frontenac sees all this and at the end ends up taking up the axe and the Leviathan mask that Nance has been wearing the entire time. Which leads me to believe that we'll get a second volume with Frontenac kind of being the new witch hammer.
Well, they got no leads about where to go now, you know, like, I don't know, like the big boss that they knew of is dead, right? But I think as far as the people that were transformed, I'm pretty sure that those were followers of Leviathan.
Yes.
Because she says like, reveal yourself through the flesh of the faithful.
There you go.
So that really, I think, also like feeds into what we were talking about, like kind of the power of belief and faith to make this magic real. Like, that's why she couldn't just possess Nance or whatever and get him out of the picture. It's like, they only have power over people who believe. And as for the end, it really, I don't know, like I just read it again, and it seems to me like kind of, it's along what we were thinking that, you know, like Nance takes off his mask, and like seems like basically some kind of angel thing says like, you're not forgiven, which I assume is like because you were once like with these guys and you did bad stuff, So, like, they're taking him out, but now they're passing the torch to Frontenac.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And there's not really a whole lot on Frontenac through the whole issue, but we do know that she's religious, right? Because at the beginning, she's got a rosary in her hand.
She's got a crucifix.
A crucifix, that's what it is.
Just like Scully.
Just like Scully. I'm telling you, hipster Scully. And at the end, when Nance is fighting all these, witches that have turned into these demon creatures, she's reciting a prayer, right? She's like, I will fear no evil, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. So she's definitely praying to God, and maybe that's part of the reason that she's gonna be the new witch hammer, right? Maybe this is an origin story of Frontenac. Maybe this is not really ultimately what Witch Hammer will be about. It's just a way to get us to a place to see how this person became involved in witch hunting and why.
Yeah, I'd be good with that.
Yeah, cool.
Witch Hammer Zero.
Witch Hammer Zero. Oh, man. Yes. Yes. All right, so do we want to rate this up?
Yeah, you first.
35 out of 5 is my score.
Okay, yeah. Conservative. I respect that. I'll go 5 out of 5.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Terrible score, but I forgive you.
I would have been fine if it was longer, but definitely there's a lot to chew on, and it looks great, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad we got this. When did we get this? Like 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
I'm glad we got it super early because I was able to read it several times, and I always pick up a few things here and there with each read, so I'm glad that it wasn't like, hey, this book's out today, let's talk about it tonight, because I'm not sure I would have had enough time to process everything that's going on here. This might be one of my favorite things that Cullen's ever done.
Mm, awesome.
Yeah. It just, I think, personally hit me in a lot of the right places, so that's why my score is preposterous.
That's your right.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I believe in it hard enough. All right. There are no books next week because next week is Christmas week. And a lot of publishers are not putting out books next week. Shame on them. Like, it's a really skim week. I was looking at my pull list for next week. I have, like, 3 books.
Yeah. Well, I got plenty of stuff, like, stacking up, so. That's fine.
Good. Good. Good for you.
I'm chipping away.
No, I hear you. I hear you. Good for you. So we will not be having an episode next week. I hope everyone enjoys their Christmas holidays. I'm not going to wish you happy holidays because next week is Christmas. If it was just another holiday, then I would say happy holidays. But we're celebrating Christmas. And I don't believe in Christmas. Christmas sucks! I'm just kidding. Christmas is fine. Anyways, you can find us all on Twitter. Ronnie, you need to tell him hello. And we missed you. He is at Rumbar316. Travis is at The Great Magnet. I'm at Geekvine. The show is at Aftershock Pod. And we'll catch you in 2019.
Happy Festivus, everybody.
I love it. Heal yourselves!